You are listening to the Cerberus Podcast with a K, available on Cerberus.com, iTunes, Stitch.com, and Audioboo. Welcome, Podcasterberus listeners. This is me, the ever awkward James McLean, and with me is the smooth and extremely girl friendly Brian Terranova. We are missing the rough coal of the north, our dear Christian Corley, this week. So you just have to do without him. We are quite happily, as always, when we do these podcasts, when Christian isn't here, as we always say, the boys come out to play. You know, it's a little more flexible. We don't really sit on a topic. We hope that that makes it a little different, a little more fresh and alternate for you guys. I won't say better, because I think there's a lot to be said to have someone strong, domineering, and totalitarian as Christian Corley, keeping us under control. So I thought we would start, and forgive me for taking this over. We haven't even suggested who should take this over, but I just have, because we're late starting and I felt we needed to get on a move. Start with, there's a couple of bits of news. We're just not really excited. Full of news. Yeah, there's not really any exciting news today. Bit of a bugger, really, when it comes to actually doing a podcast.
You know, it's funny, actually, that is the case, especially since we are about, we're now like 2 months away from the premiere of Series 8. You would think certain things would kind of be leaking out or flooding out right now.
Well, yeah, there's a couple of photos from Cardiff, isn't there, and stuff like that, but... yeah, by and large, it's pretty dull. So we'll just go through a few news items. I mean, the first one I think we're going to pick up very briefly. We've sort of said it before, but it seems to have come up again as if it's particularly interesting news. There is talk. I'm concerned about whether the people are going to complain about this as a spoiler or not. There is rumour, because it's not definite, that the Master again is being reared up as being a potential for the this next series. We've talked about this before, so I don't really think we are spoiling, are we? It's we don't know it's true. And it's only the Daily Star, which isn't exactly the most considered publicly the most definitive of guaranteed material, shall we say. Do you want the Master to come back? I mean, I know we've talked about this a little before, but we'll just talk about it a little again. And if you do, would you be looking for a very different Master, or would you be looking for John Sim for a bit, or would you be looking for something like John Sim, or would you like something throwback to one of the greats like Eric Roberts? What would your thoughts?
One of the greats, like, yeah, nice. I you know, honestly, I was a fan of the fact that Anthony Ainley could kind of span so many Doctors, and that they didn't always have to regenerate the Master every time there was a new Doctor, especially. This thing where, you know, Russell felt that the Doctor and the Master should be rejuvenated and young to match the rejuvenated and young Doctor at the time, which is a shame, because while John Sim was fantastic, you know, it really kind of was sad to have had Derek Jacobi for such a short time, because he just seemed like those few moments that he got to be the Master, he was so, if you'll excuse me, he was so masterfully at it. You know, it was great. So I think it would be sad if we bring in Peter Capaldi and they go ahead and go, well, we've got an older Doctor, we've got to bring in an older Master again. Like, I don't think they need to actually be a mirror image of one another, but I would like to see him back, because I do like the Master, and I do know that some people are tired of him, this, that, and the other, but I think that if you get a good writer on the story, and you can tell the story in an interesting way, or a different way, or a new way, you can always make something fresh and new, or at least just fresh in some kind of way. This way you're not getting bored with the same old.
Remind me, did you listen to Schalke? Did you listen to Jacobi in
Oh, yes, yes, Schalke? I did.
Yeah, you did, yeah. And you liked that, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. Well, I mean, I liked him, certainly. Yeah. I will say, no offense to Paul Cornell, because he's written some very nice Doctor Who TV stories, that's for sure, but... I wasn't entirely into Schalke. I liked the base story, but I don't think I quite liked his direction for the Doctor and so on. But it was the first story, and you can never really judge a doctor on their first story either. So if it had gone to more, I'm curious to find out what I would have thought. But I did like the premise. I liked a lot of the ideas he had put into it. I'll say that. And one of those things was Jacoby. I was interested in where they were going with that, and finding out how it turned out to be the situation that it was in there, how he turned out to be kind of that constant traveling companion of the doctor's, which funnily enough is an idea that a friend and I were toying with for a fan film years ago, primarily because, you know, kids, as you do, you want to both play a Time Lord, and we just thought it would be fun to see what these two guys who used to be friends would be like if they were stuck together in a situation where they had to rely on each other, but they're not quite friends anymore. And so the idea definitely appealed to me from that perspective. But I also think in this show, if they bring them back and they have him in a different body, not John Sim, then the best way, obviously, to do it would be to bring him back and have the doctor not really have an idea that he's there, and make it be like a big reveal that it's him. So if these rumors are coming out and it gets tagged to an actor's name, then just like Derek Jacobi before, the surprise factor is going to be gone. But, you know, they've already tried it once in the new series. So do you need to go that direction?
Mm.
How about you? What do you think about this?
Yeah. I mean, I think I have a horrible feeling I've spoken about this more than you, which is why I'm a little cautious about going into it too much. Yeah, I'm all for it. I mean, I'm very pro John Sim coming back. I know I don't think he is, which I think is a great shame if this is a reveal for the Master. I think that's a missed opportunity. But overall, I think he's a good character. Again, as you say, it's how it's written, how he's used. I think it would be nice to see the Master used in something a little more. I'm not a big massive Pertwee fan, so I don't take this as a sort of, oh God, the good old days. But the sort of unit factor, I think, works well with the Master, where you can sort of pull back the monster threat and let a human face take the front. So I think if they use him in that way, I think that's a very powerful way to use the Master, as if he's a sort of more like the Avengers antagonist. But yes, we will see. Sea Devils, this is another sort of slight oddity. Odd news, a Sea Devil costume has turned up that is said to be from around 1972, but in fact is looking like it could possibly be a fan made from the 90s. It is an oddity to see in itself, but then if you go to any of these exhibitions, when you see the actual costumes, they do tend to look slightly worse than they did on the show.
Yeah.
Which of course, for a show which has a reputation of having slightly worse monsters, makes them slightly worse.
Plus the aging on them, you know what I mean?
Yes,
They were kind of a little budgeted in the beginning, but they weren't going to age well, you know.
Absolutely. any feelings on this? I mean, we were just talking about this a little earlier, but you have a feeling that it's probably probably a fake. Well, not a fake, but do you know what I mean? That it's not. It was brought on the fact that it was an authentic BBC prop, where it's looking like it possibly isn't.
Honestly, you know, we quoted in the article the blog from Purple Blancmange, I believe is how it's said, and. I know him from the prop communities and the prop world, and I do have to say he generally has a lot of good, reliable information because he's had ties to the BBC and so on. So I'm inclined to agree with him that this is a 90s fan-made replica. I mean, if that's what he says, it's a 90s fan-made replica. I, looking at it, would have said it's not original just from what I know of the pieces. But it's still, I mean, so it's from the 90s. It's a nice thing. It would make a nice addition to someone's collection, but trying to pass it off as original just would not be fair, really. So,
yes. Yeah. I mean, I think I pretty much sit on the same page on that. Those are the two bits. I mean, as I say, there's been a bit, you know, there's Capaldi being seen and Clara in Cardiff filming, and there's some more spoilerish pictures. I'm cautious about sort of saying too much about these, because we got into trouble for the podcast where Christian let out a spoiler and which he probably shouldn't have about the TARDIS, and someone wasn't very happy with that. Yeah. But there we go. Yeah, they're not really particularly spoiler. They're quite nice. Coleman looking quite nice in those. But they will be linked to this podcast if you have not already seen them. We had some quite nice responses on the Torchwood debate, which is now sort of doubled in size, since we obviously had a first article which was written on the regards of Torchwood and its failings, what was inherently wrong with it. That article did very well comic wise. It's one of our sort of new feature pieces that was by Andy Frank, Frank Mallon, who was very good in his response as well, went into the comments and sort of dialogued, which is always nice that they're happy to listen to comments and criticisms, because there was a few people who didn't agree, including myself. I don't know, have you read any of the comments on the last week's podcast? It actually did quite well. We had a lot of people listening to that.
Yeah, no, I saw the response to it, the amount of listens, but I have not gone through the comments. I'll be honest. Sometimes going through the comments is not a good idea. You know, sometimes I just feel like it's not something I should do, because sometimes you get people who have, you know, nice compliments for our podcast. Sometimes you get people who have very good points, very good comments, and I'm like, wow, yeah, that's a good angle. I wish we thought of that in the podcast. And then other times you get people who just, you don't know if they're posting there just because they, you know, the trolls, the internet trolls, as they're called. And sometimes I just don't feel like dealing with that, so I just kind of stay away from the comments. But a lot of them, I mean, when I did, like I said, there are some times that you want to sit there and you say, that guy or that girl, whoever they are, whoever just made that comment, I wish you were in the podcast, because that's a good point. So, you know, sometimes I really should go through, because I do miss that, which is actually something I'm looking at another article here on the K that I'll bring up in a moment, which kind of leads into that kind of thing. But I'll let you, if you have any more on.
No, not really. Podcast. I mean, there was a point that someone stood corrected me from what I said last week, that the Torchwood had a sanitized version. It was pointed out that the sanitized version didn't come out till after the show started to air, as if it was done by demand. I don't know if that's true or not. I don't know whether they always planned it or whether I think it's a debate that I would really need more factual information on before. I mean, that's what I was finding when I was responding and arguing. I was thinking, I've got no facts here. I don't really know much about the process that led to Torchwood. I mean, it was at a time, it was 2005, you know, when Torchwood was, you know, given, it was the point where they would start thinking of doing it. And, you know, it had only been going for a year. So Doctor Who was, you know, a new family show, which hadn't been done in Britain in that sort of approach for so long. They didn't really know what was going on. So it's hard to know what the processes were. Did they know it'd go on to BBC, and BBC Three having such a young adult audience would have to be the catchment? Did they plan that they might need to look at children? Did Russell T. Davies just think that I'm a liberal man, I'm going to do one for adults, children don't need to, I don't care about the children, parents can just keep them away, or it won't harm the children. I mean, the only thing I will say is I have noticed that Torchwood really wasn't as bad, was no worse than EastEnders or Coronation Street in terms of sort of the sexual comments and the adult material. And they're on at like sort of 8 o'clock at night, and no one really bats an eyelid at that. And yet Torchwood has got the same sort of stuff, and suddenly everyone's focused and sort of saying, you know, is this puerile? Is it too hard for kids and everything? Well, families will sit and watch a soap together. So, you know, I don't know. I just wonder whether, you know, it is a bit more of a big deal. Biggest problem, as I say, is I don't think it was very good. So what were you going to say? You said you saw another article.
Yeah, it's just something that appealed, I guess, to me and my interest. So I figure some of the listeners and so on might actually feel the same. But it was and you know, I'm sorry, everybody's going to have to forgive me. I've been away for a couple of days at a convention, so I really have not been paying attention to the site or the real world. So I haven't really gone through this article fully. I'm going kind of merely on the title and want to give my two cents on it. But the title is, Has Internet and Social Media Killed Fan Meetups? And I have to say, I am aware of many fan Doctor Who groups in my area, and friends who are constantly inviting me to them, and a few that I had gone to in the past. And I know that there are people out there that still enjoy the social interaction, and certainly, you know, I don't know if conventions can count, but certainly these people all gather together at conventions. And just, I had my police box at this convention. Okay, so it was my booth at Wizard World Convention, and my TARDIS there. We were just, it was a photo opportunity, and I cannot tell you how many people every day in Doctor Who costumes hung around my box just to hang out with each other and talk. Even people who weren't in Doctor Who costumes wanted to hang and talk, and it was like, I really don't think people can get that kind of interaction on the internet and social media. And not to say that they're bad, because it's a nice way to keep up with people, certainly over long distance. But I can't, from what I can see, I can't see that they're dead whatsoever. And as I said, I didn't read this article, so I don't know what the conclusion is by Nick here. But I just wanted to give my two cents there, because I as I said, I know so many people who do that. And from my experience, one of my things that I'm finding sad anymore is that internet forums I'm finding I'm really disinterested in them anymore because it seems that rather than people talking really cool, fun fan theories or interesting comments or thoughts on the show are all just turning into nitpicks or supposed experts out on the net, you know? And I'll be honest, you know, like in the prop world, you know, in the prop community world, I have I've done my fair share of discoveries and research and so on. But if somebody else has more correct information, you bow to it. You know, they've got it. You know, you go with that. Even if those people are not exactly the nicest people on the net, I'm not going to sit there and argue with them and tell them their information's wrong if they're right. You know, I just don't understand why internet. I mean, I do. I get it. It's the faceless medium, and I get that. So it's so easy to put your thoughts out there, even if you're wrong, and stick by them. So factually or non-factually, if you will, because no one can really can do anything to get, you know, get prove you wrong, because they don't know who you are. You can hide in the shadows and you can say to yourself at home, they're right, but I'm
Oh,
never going
yeah.
to tell them they're right, you know.
Well, it gets
So
more insidious because you'll get ones who can, because of the anonymous nature, can actually pretend they're something they're not. And it's amazing
exactly.
how many people suddenly work in BBC Cardiff,
Yes,
or
yes.
work on the show, or their friend is the producer. And
Right.
you know, so it becomes even harder because it becomes disingenuous to honest debate because, as you say, there's this wall. But then I've noticed that I've tended to find in the last few years forums are sort of in a very big decay. Again, because of social media and everyone's sort of more moving to Facebooks and more networked social mediums. So forums themselves seem to be losing a lot in themselves too. So, and I
Well,
must
that's
admit,
interesting.
I
Sorry.
found that anyway. I mean, I used to work for an animation forum, and you know, back in 2001 to about 2006, you know, the heyday of forums before Facebook and even MySpace had really
Yeah.
caught on. That's where people went to talk about animation and films, and it was, you know, buzzing, it was big, it was exciting. We could pull in actors and write and animators and voice, mainly voice artists, to be honest, and get them to chat and work with them and do artwork with them. It was, you know, some very fun stuff. But now, I mean, the same place, still a lovely place. I still pop back there occasionally, and I miss the people I used to work with. It's still not the same because it's just, as you say, social media has just encroached on so many levels of social interaction, and yeah,
Yeah.
It's a shame because the problem with social media is it's not just interaction between fans. There's so much cross-pollination within the industry trying to sell you stuff and trying to get you to like pages and get you into buying things, which is just commerce. But it's very it's not very personal. It doesn't feel very personal, even though it should do because you're all on each other's profiles and everything. But anyway, I don't know.
No,
Maybe I'm
you know
just
what
getting
that.
old.
No, that's a very good point that you make, because honestly, belonging, like I said, to all these fan communities online, like certainly the prop world and just even Doctor Who in general, you know, collecting the props is fun, and I have plenty of friends that I can share that with, and some of them are online because some of them are across the world, some of them are right here in my hometown, and you know, we can all just, you know, share what we've collected or make films with them or do whatever. But you know, you still kind of want to, you kind of want to have a display for it some way. You know, you can't exactly go put your stuff on public display for many reasons, because anything can happen to them. But, and you know, I'm paranoid about that kind of stuff. But you want to kind of share it out there and just say, you know, other people might appreciate this and maybe want to know where to get it as well. So you want to find forums where you can share that kind of thing. And what I've noticed over the past few years, certainly since I started collecting them, which was 2004, those kind of places have really died down, and social media has really kicked up. So, you know, I'm sharing these things on Facebook anymore more than anywhere else. And for this article to say, has the internet and social media killed fan meetups? I'm not seeing that, but I am seeing, you know, the social media kind of killing the forums, as you suggested there. I do truly believe that. I mean, there's one forum that I belong to. I'm not going to mention the name because I don't want to down the forum whatsoever, but it seems like it's a perfect place for Doctor Who fans to go for sharing your props, your costumes, even just talking about the show. It seems like a really nice setup forum. People seemed friendly, but unfortunately there's like a new post like once a week almost, it seems. And it's like it's a shame. I don't know what's happened here. Like it seemed like a good home, and then all of a sudden there's nothing. You know, while other places like the Replica Prop Forum is thriving, and that's good because I mean it's a broad spectrum prop place, and it's very good that people still have that. I just find it sad that, you know, doing even just like a Google search for some kind of Doctor Who forum, in some way, they're just kind of not really happening. And there are other forums out there. Again, I guess I won't mention names if I'm being negative, I guess, about them. But there are other forums out there where I just feel are too sub-forumed. You know, there's too much to it that it's so hard to navigate. And while it may be a thriving place, it's not a place I can spend any time in.
I mean, as I say, having worked on forums, it used to be always a question of balancing out your population traffic to the amount of sub-forums you had. And a lot of forums never learned that you need to start small and work big. And I think I know which forums you're referring to, which are massive. And to be fair to them, they do have a lot of traffic to be able to do that.
Sure,
but it does mean that, you know, if you're sort of a passing by fan, it's not particularly it doesn't particularly draw you in. But it is an interesting conversation to have. I think where it's going, because as I say, it's always changing, the media and the way it's trending. I mean, again, I was playing Doctor Who Legacy, as I keep saying, this week, and I went and got the second Doctor key code to unlock him, and thinking how different even video games are, in the sense, you know, once you buy your video game and that would be it would be criticized when it came out or applauded, and that would be what you'd have. But now you have things like, you know, Legacy, which is now constantly updated, which stays very close to its fan base with its Facebook page, its newsletters, so it's keeping itself very in touch with its people, listening, adapting, evolving on the spot based on what the feedback is, and therefore by doing so becoming more successful from it. And so, you know, it's a very good capitalist, even though it's technically a non-profit venture by the BBC, but it's a very good commerce approach, and it's also at the same time it's a very good social interaction approach. And it's just a very different kettle of fish, you know, to have that, to think, you know, I'm playing this game, in the next months another version is going to come up with more updates, more changes, more characters to appear. It's just constantly altering, and it's again, it ties into this whole social media thing, is that the digital age is just so evolving so incredibly fast.
That's actually really interesting to hear, because, you know, as you know, I'm not really like a big gamer, but I do know so many people that, you know, they play a game and they get to the end and then, you know, they say it's great, they'll play it again and they'll try all sorts of different things, whatever. But then they just go, I can't wait for that next one to come out. I can't wait. I'm looking for something new. But to hear that there's a game out there that's just kind of constantly updating sounds like a very great premise for those gamers. I mean, it seems like you'll almost never be bored with it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of scary, isn't it? Because I was thinking that. I was playing this and thinking, I've been playing this a hell of a lot. Because once I got the second Doctor, he comes in at the base rank. So I've spent hours boosting his rank up so he's going to be of some use. And I did that with the other ones that I really liked. I say Handles. I'd just done that with Handles and the Oswin Oswald Dalek, which is, I think I said in a previous podcast, I felt so sorry for her in the actual show. I had to have her on my team and give her an extra bit of life, you know. So I spent a lot of time. So you're doing all this. You think, I'm going to get bored, but when they're going to do a version two and there's going to be slight changes to revitalize the very simple premise and the way it works, you think, is this like some sort of far more effective drug than heroin? Because, you know, heroin will stay very, heroin's about trace, is, you know, allegedly anyway, as I don't know myself, is about chasing that original high. It's like, well, this is a better drug, isn't it? Because the high just gets better. You're not chasing that original feeling. You're waiting for a new feeling to come along. So it's weird. It's a weird, crazy world that we're living in.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's very interesting. A lot of people are, you know, I shouldn't say that. It's very easy to blame the internet for like the death of certain things, I guess, as we were just trying to talk about right there. But at the same time, or even technology, you know, certainly people blame phones for the lack of human social interaction, which, to be honest, you know, I'm is out there. And I think at the same time, there's plenty of the proof that it's not fully dead. But it's interesting that technology is doing so many awesome things. First of all, you and I are talking right now.
Absolutely.
You know, and that's always been my favorite thing about it.
Like, definitely.
Christian and Anthony, like, I would never know you guys.
I know. It's brilliant, isn't it? And we take it for granted. As you say, I mean, like back in the mid-90s, you very rarely talk to someone outside your own country. And now it's just commonplace. It's an incredible thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I have one of my best friends is in Australia.
Yeah.
And you know, it's just you just sit here and you don't feel far away.
No.
You know, you really, I mean, like, I wish I could get out there to visit you guys, like certainly meet you in person and visit Christian and Anthony again, but it's just weird, like the way that we seem to talk and know each other. Like whenever I talk to people about you and about what we do and so on, you know, you're as much as one of my friends as the people that I see every day. You know, there's none of this, there's this guy I know on the internet. It's not that, you know, you're my friend, you know, and it's so amazing how small the world can seem lately, and how amazing that this technology can bring this little thing, something like Doctor Who, this tiny part of our lives that we all enjoy. And let's be fair. I mean, like, yeah, it's a big show, and yes, we love it so much, but that's not who we are. It doesn't make up our persons, you know. So it is a tiny part of our lives, you know, and but it's made it be this stepping stone for meeting people like you and all these people that I have met in my lives lately. Like, I have met some of the best friends in my life through this show. So maybe I shouldn't call it a tiny part. Maybe it's unfair to call it a tiny part, but you know what I'm trying to say there, I guess. But it's just amazing. And the more that they can enhance that, the more they can do things like these games that get you talking with other people playing the games, you know, we'll just constantly do that. We'll just constantly make new friends, you know, or give us some kind of entertainment to always have something when we go out to our social gatherings in person to relate to other people with. I just find it amazing. I don't know. I think it's a great time we're in.
I think in a lot of ways it is. I mean, there's obviously a lot of problems and it can be a very inhibitive thing. I mean, I think when people talk about phones, you think, well, it's the same sort of argument people used to have about television, wasn't it? That people used to be terrified that there was no more social interaction in homes because everyone would just sit and watch television. And you think, well, they do, but they survive. And if they're happy, who cares? And there's a certain feel like that with phones. If they're happy tapping on them, I tap on it far too much. I can be really rude with a phone. I've always been a very intense sort of guy who has to be doing something, who loves getting focused in my own little world, and you know, reading and phones is just like a naughty extrapolation of that desire to just who loves sitting and just absorbing stuff. So yeah, it is a weird world, and it's very interesting when you get shows like Doctor Who that will actually expand on it in a science fiction sort of way, like Rise of the Cybermen. Where you sort of question the technology and how far that could extrapolate to where it could go. And sometimes it does get worrying, you know, when you hear about active robots being made to sort of protect with certain sort of artificial intelligent parameters and where you can go with technology. And I don't know, it's scary, but at the same time, on our level, it's pretty exciting. Well, so yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's always downsides to anything, and of course, you know, you've got to be careful. Like the fact that phones tag your location, your timestamp, and so on. That, you know, obviously, if you're taking pictures of your kids, you got to be careful about that stuff. So there's always scary aspects to it. But yeah, I mean, you know, if the sad thing is that people like you and I, we're always going to focus on the positives. Like you're very much aware of the negatives, and I'm very much aware of the negatives, but we're the people that are going to focus on the positives, use the positives, and just keep going from there. So while the technology is there and it does have these downsides, it's not the technology, it's the people that exploit the downsides,
Yes,
and that
absolutely.
they're the problem, and that's always going to be the issue, and it's going to be their technology or not. Those people are going to exploit the negatives of anything, and
Well,
you know.
I think the scary thing with the technology is not so much the actual nature of it, but it moves at such a fast pace that society is at a has a problem actually being able to reconcile its potential and its abilities. I mean, you know, I we're not going to go political here. You know, there's obviously a lot
Sure,
of talk over intelligence gathering and you know, Google and all the data and the like. And part of the problem is that it all happens before anyone really has a chance to assimilate it because it happens so fast. And the pioneers are there at the forefront with these companies and with these governments and the like. And so it's happening before everyone can ingest it, and even perhaps even before the governments and the companies can ingest it. So the ramifications aren't really dealt with because the technology is moving too fast for society to do so. So, you know, again, as I say, I'm not looking at making a point here on either side of any debate, just saying that it's such a fast-moving thing, technology, that it causes this thing where everyone is having to sort of almost like catch up with it to try and decide whether what's happening is good or whether it's bad.
You know what? You've actually just made a very interesting point for me, because, and I know that you and I did a podcast together already on Revenge of the Cybermen
Yes.
and Rise of the Cybermen. So I don't want to go down that path too much on this one, but it is actually relevant because Monday last week, last Monday, I guess it was, Rise of the Cybermen and The Age of Steel just aired in theaters here in the U.S.
Oh, yeah.
Which I did not get to see. Unfortunately, I had to work, so I had to miss it. But so I missed the exclusive content as well, which really bugged me. But I do like that story, as we had talked about. I do like that story. But the issue that people evolved into Cybermen merely because of their love of technology rather than their fear of dying and replacing themselves with mechanical body parts. It never really did sit well with me, but the way that you just explained it there of how it's all progressing so fast before people can process it made it so much better for me right there, because I hadn't considered that aspect all these years. It just really hadn't, I guess, registered with me that that is a very fair way of putting it, that all these people were just like, check out this new awesome phone that I got, that this thing crept up on them. It wasn't really their love of technology made them embrace becoming a Cyberman. They just didn't see it coming. And I don't know why that hasn't really dawned on me until you put it in those words. But that's such a, I don't know, just such a perfect way of putting it that just made me kind of appreciate that aspect all the more, which is good because I've already liked the story and now I can feel better about that aspect.
Yeah, I think it was one of the good things that Davis did there. And I'm not going to go into Moffat bashing on this. I'm just trying to think if we've
Sure.
really had much of it in the Moffat era. Because I mean, I suppose we have with the Bells of St. John, sort of did a similar sort of thing where it sort of looked at the technology of routers
Sure.
and social connection. And I think sometimes, obviously, one of the strongest points of Doctor Who has been over the years has been its ability to actually do what science fiction is meant to do, is obviously assess contemporary trends and then extrapolate them into a broader idea, into a broader fantasy idea. And Doctor Who's done that on so many occasions, as we said before, obviously the Sunmakers being an example of one with bureaucracy, and
Yes.
there's hundreds of them, there's
Yeah, well, yeah, no,
allegories.
and that's always, I mean, that's always a good base for anything, because you're taking something that people can relate to or understand, and when you can put it certainly in something like Doctor Who, you could tell a story with monsters, and their ultimate goal is they need this rare mineral that we never even knew was on our planet, and it's an okay story, it's a fun story, but people don't really kind of have, a base for understanding on that story, aside from the fact that aliens are coming to get something and we have to stop them. But you can take something that they can completely, absolutely wrap their head around and relate to, and you've got them a little bit more invested in the story. And that's going to happen in any TV show, but it is very interesting in those stories because those are a lot of the ones that do kind of make you really think a lot, which is always a good thing. I mean, you always want to walk away not just from a TV show going, that was a fun adventure, but if a show leaves you thinking. That's job well done.
And it's also kind of becomes exciting on a historical perspective because these fall into eras. I mean, you can, as we've said before, Cybermen, 10th Planet, it was, the fear of the new organ replacement technology and where medicine was going. You could go even further. You can sort of say, take the 70s, sorry, so 70, 80s was very much about the Cold War. So most of the stories were about nuclear holocaust. There was the fear of, of a third world war. So science fiction went very much down that route, as did Doctor Who to a degree. By the time you get to the 90s, you're starting to talk about corporations and the fear of corporations and the control
Sure.
of corporations on the bodies, and a lot of the books were about corporations. And you get to the sort of 2000s, I would say corporations obviously still a factor, but I would say the big thing has been obviously terrorism and the act of fear, and maybe also something a little more personal. There seems to be a lot more interest in personal fear, in predatory, in victims, and serial killers and the like. So it's interesting. Science fiction expands, and you can date it historically, and that is also fascinating because you can look back at Rise of the Cybermen, and it's Bluetooth and wireless coming, becoming far more in the home, and that was very much systematic at that time, and so it becomes historical, and that's kind of cool as well because you're sort
Yeah.
of pinch you're feeling the fears and the interest and the fascinations of the time.
That's another very interesting point there, because you're right. When 9/11 happened, so many TV shows cropped up not long after about the terrorism. And what you've made me realize is that there are certain things that Doctor Who won't touch. And in fairness, it does kind of make sense. doesn't seem the platform for something like that. But we have not seen a terrorism plot in Doctor Who.
No.
And it does make sense, because how would you properly do it? I mean, you could do an alien planet where there's kind of their own kind of terrorism situation going on, but you would change the parameters. You wouldn't make it as frightening as it is in reality. And it's just interesting, the ones that they will pick up on that they can tell, because at the end of the day, Doctor Who does not, they don't seem like they're a show that really, you know, while they give you some things to think about, certainly they don't seem like they're a show that's trying to prove a point in any kind of way. That it's, at the end of the day, it is about entertainment, which is something that I extremely do value in the show. Because one of my favorite things, of course, is the escape from reality. You know, you don't want to turn on the TV and only see the things that you're constantly hear about all day long at work, you know, or on the news. You want to get an escape from it. And while they do touch on some reality things, and as you said, you can follow an interesting base of history through it, I don't think I'd want to see that kind of reality creep into the show. I don't think I want to feel that much like I'm at in the real world with it, you know. And so that's a very interesting concept or thought, rather, that they just won't touch things.
I find it very interesting in current American films, and I've been struggling to wonder whether this is a catharsism, you know, a weird sort of catharsism, or whether it's been delayed because of things like 9/11. But there seems to be a lot more sort of city destruction that seems to occur. In a lot of films seem to be about sort of destroying cities, and you think, did 9/11 paralyze the ability for film, you know, where technology was getting to the point where you could knock down cities in CG? It was obviously something that understandably was not something that people really wanted to focus on. So it was held back. And now suddenly, you know, 10 years later, suddenly feeling, well, we can get away with doing it. Now people are a little less sensitive to that, and we can enjoy the sort of mass destruction. Or is there some sort of weird catharsism in seeing things being destroyed, but on your terms, without the fear? I don't know. It seems to be trends. It's another sort of trend at the moment, seems to be, can we level a city with people in it? And you think, well, you couldn't have done that 10 years ago, not technology wise, but just simply because it would have been uncomfortable for a lot of people, because it was a big fear. The progression of technology and how science fiction deals with it is a fascinating thing. And I'm so glad that Doctor Who gets to sort of touch upon it quite gently, perhaps, as I say, not so much these days as it used to, which may be a shame, or maybe it's more subtle than it was. I don't know.
Or, you know, and as we had said, it all comes down to different eras and different writers. You know, perhaps the particular writers on the shows just aren't inclined that way. But when Moffat moves on, maybe a new producer who comes in will. I mean, just even look at the change from Christopher Biedmid. When he came in the show, like,
yes,
everything became very scientific.
Yes.
You know? And it was, I still enjoy that season very much, probably more so for the change. And I don't want to sit here and say one's better than the other, because I just really enjoy them both. But, you know, he clearly had a vision and an interest of his own that he thought people might enjoy. So you never know, we might get somebody who comes in the show later who does want to bring us back a little bit to the real life issues in some way, somehow, or even with a story. I mean, who knows what we'll find in Capaldi's era, but it could just be simply that, you know, the current group of writers aren't that way. And that's one of the fantastic things about the show, is how different every era is and the different things that you can find in them and take away from them. Certainly, again, being away this weekend, meeting all these different fans and, you know, talking with them about who's their favorite, what's their favorite era and their favorite story. Everybody is so vastly different. It's amazing. There isn't just, say, like, Tom Baker is the best and Genesis of the Daleks is the best story, and that's just it, period, forever. So vast opinions, and it's amazing.
You'll never find one story which everyone agrees on as being being the best. There'll always be someone who will say, actually, I can't stand that story. There's just not one, don't think. It's incredible. Do you think one of the things the new show perhaps misses, and correct me if I'm wrong, and listener, if you've got an example of this that I've missed because it's just off the spur, please say, but the idea of when Doctor Who very much plays on either the social satire or on the technological satire of an era. Do you think when we've got some of the big baddies that keep coming back, like the Cybermen or the Daleks or even the Ice Warriors, do you think stories which would place them into those sort of contexts would work better for them? I'm just thinking of one of the reasons maybe that Nightmare in Silver didn't really work was that it had no real sort of backbone in reality. There was nothing there that you could really sort of connect to. It was basically watching the Doctor fighting another mind and people trying to survive a siege.
Well, yeah. See, here's the thing. For me, it's a tough answer. It's not like a yes or no kind of answer to me, because as we kind of said in the beginning of this thing, it all comes down to a creative writer doing something interesting with an old character. Because I think, you know, certainly, and you know, one of my big upsetting elements is the Suntarans and what has happened to the Suntarans ever since Strax. I don't think that people will take them seriously on screen now. But then I have to sit there and I have to say, you know, some writer can come into the show and say, I can make them a threat again. I can make them interesting again. And, you know, I'm sure they will. And I would love to see that happen. So I think there is a good merit that you can use a classic monster like that. And certainly I think even the Daleks would work great in certain, certainly if you wanted to do it, for instance, a touch on terrorism, you know, Daleks would probably be a great one to fit into that slot, you know, and somebody could do something quite interesting with that. But at the same time, I agree with you that that's probably one of the reasons why Nightmare in Silver didn't work very well, but it doesn't mean that you do need it to make that story work, because I think a creative writer, and this is a shame because I anymore I've been trying not to down writers and so on for, in this for the story, because you know I don't know what goes into writing their story. I don't know what changed from what they wrote till it went out on film, so I don't want to do that. But you know, I really think that somebody could have told a story similar to Nightmare in Silver that could have just worked and been interesting, because to me the Cybermen, the biggest, scariest threat that they have going for them is that they are relentless. Their goal is to make you into them, and that's it. And they won't stop. You know, you don't really need much more. You know, you may have to put other situations around other people to put more drama into it, but I think when you get into an element where the Cybermen have some kind of other goal, you're kind of making them a little less threatening in some way. Now, if their goal is going to further their conversion of the universe, then yeah, I can get that. But I don't know. I just think this fact that this faceless or thousands of similar faces race that all talk the same, all look the same, all act the same, are just coming at you. You can't reason with them. You can't talk to them. You can't do anything with them aside from run away from them is scary as hell. And somebody just needs to find out how to write that again.
Well, maybe they need to sort of try and I think the way to do it, if you're doing on the sort of the, because you have two different sort of type of monster stories, right? You have either the single unstoppable or you have the mass unstoppable. Sure. And if you're doing the mass unstoppable, like in Nightmare of Silver, I think if you look at, say, with the Cybermen, you need to strip it back to, say, looking at, say, Aliens as a film. Yeah. And you have a relentless foe that you can't argue with, you can't dialogue with, you can't plead with. It is relentless with its own agenda. But if you'd say taken the alien and then put a queen alien that sort of had a long chat with Ripley in her head, you know, and she was having to fight its influence in her head, or it was specifically after the children, because it takes the terror away, because the terror becomes more complex. Sure. Now, and that's to say, Nightmare in Silver, the dialogue between Smith and Smith was the best bit of it. So I'm not Absolutely. Saying that it was bad, but within the context of the story, it should be one or the other. And I think as soon as you have that, and then you try and have the minor Cybermen on top, they sort of lose what they're about. And sometimes I think, you know, stripping it back, I think sometimes it's where sort of taking a satire of a contemporary issue can help, because it gives you a bit of a grounding. Yeah. But I think you're right. I think when it comes to the monsters, it is, I think, one of the mistakes writers make is that, because they're trying to make them interesting, they try and add to them, when in fact, no, you've got to sort of believe in the basic template of the monster, then strip it back. Don't push it forward, because you don't need to. And, you know, the Cybermen don't need that. You don't need thousands of Cybermen. You know, in theory, you only need one that should have that same fear. Two or three should be able to do it. And again, as we've said before, as soon as you have a million and they can hold themselves out against millions, suddenly the one becomes suddenly seems very weak.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same thing like with the Daleks, exact same thing. That's why with the new series, I've been very vocal about it. Like the Cult of Skaarow is just that they are my favorite Daleks, period. And I think part of it is because I really loved in the classic series, you didn't need an army of Daleks. There were stories where three or four of them were sent on a mission, and that was all that was necessary. And it took six episodes to stop them. You know, like that to me is amazing. And not to knock Parting of the Ways, because I really think that was a great series ender. And it was really awesome to see so many Daleks. But I don't think every time we see the Daleks again, they need to be in mass like that, or even the Cybermen. I think you can tell a great freaky story with just a handful, because it does show how threatening they are,
yeah,
in both of them, that this small little group can be that empowering over a mass amount of humans. I think that's just, I don't know, that is where a great amount of fear comes from me. Not to say that if you're surrounded by a million of them, you're not going to be, you know, terrified.
But that's
obviously,
that's precisely right. The problem, though, isn't it? As soon as you've got a million, you've created stakes so high, the writer has to either weaken them to make it so your small rabble can survive, or the small rabble have got to do something so extremely absurd to survive against so many. So automatically, as soon as you put too many in, you create odds, which means the writer's going to have to start fudging in some way. And, you know, I think Parting the Ways was, in a sense, brilliant because, aside from the Bad Wolf ending, which people would argue is a fudge, it did mean that the Daleks were never fudged in their time on the station. They were unstoppable. You know,
yes.
There was no way. Even Captain Jack couldn't stop them. The Doctor couldn't stop them. They weren't weakened in any way to stop them until you had this sort of big godlike ending. So that is the problem. So when you have, say, as you say, three or four, you create odds which are a little more realistic. You feel that your rabble could actually possibly beat three or four Daleks or three or four Cybermen. It'd be hard, but they could do it. And so it brings things on a level where they can survive.
And the other thing with like three or four of them, you can find creative ways to stop them. You know, like in the classic series, you know, the old joke, my vision is impaired, you know, it was always take out their eye stalk. But you know what? It is a clever way. If you blind someone, what can they do but shoot blindly themselves, you know? But, you know, you can hopefully avoid that. But with their shields, and granted, they had to make the Daleks more powerful and stronger, you know, and with their shields, taking out their eye stalk is harder. So what I'd like to see is a clever way of someone to avoid their shields. And, you know, I actually have a way, and I guess I don't, it's a shame, I don't want to say I have a way and then not say what it is, but a friend and I were working on a film, and we were going to use a couple of local friends' Daleks for it. But I had an interesting idea for it. And, you know, I'll put it out there. Maybe Stephen Moffat will steal it, because I don't know if this film will ever get made. So the old joke, Stephen Moffat will steal from us. He knows it. I had this interesting thought that, just a silly idea. And you know, you can come up with any old idea, but the bullets, regular old bullets, couldn't pierce those Dalek shields to shoot that eye stalk out. But I had this thought that, you know, the Doctor had to work with UNIT at some point and created sonic bullets. And now, bear with me when I say this, it's not like a sonic screwdriver. So it's not like that kind of thing. I called them whistlers. And what it was just like this bullet that was designed in such a way that put out this, as air passed through it, it created like a sonic resonance that would disrupt their shield so that the bullet could penetrate the shield and pierce the armor. And for me, it was just a necessity for the story. So this way I could actually find a way to stop a Dalek. And I thought, if I can think of a clever way to get around those shields, somebody else can in the story. And that would be interesting, you know. But it's very hard to do, like you said, when the Daleks are millions of them in mass, you know.
Well, the Daleks are a very interesting thing as you talk about that, because there's two ways to look at them. And in the old series, I used to argue, because there was the whole thing about the problem getting upstairs, and there was always a feeling you could sort of say, well, you could jump on the back of the Dalek and it could do sod all, and you could ride on the back. But the point was, is that you could do that to a Nazi soldier, but the worry with, say, within a war would not be the fact of the one soldier. It would be, yes, you could kill the one soldier, but then they could gas your town. Or they could destroy your town. And that was, to me, very much what the Daleks were like. They didn't have to be perfect individual killing machines, because they were an empire. So, and I think Remembrance of the Daleks does this very well, where the Doctor points out, you know, they could just sterilize this whole area if they really wanted to. There's that sort of potential to them. which works better in a story sense, because it sort of says, well, okay, they're up there, they could sterilize, but they're not all around the place. That gives the protagonist room to move and to play their own game without feeling like they're totally suffocated by the enemy. But the enemy still has that same factor that if it push comes to the shove, they could just wipe everything out. So they keep that threat. When, as you say, as soon as you make the Daleks tanks in themselves, it makes it more problematic because, as you say, you have problems actually being able to individually destroy them because they're so powerful. And therefore, again, you go back to this whole thing, is a fudge going to have to be created to get past the fact they're so powerful? So in a sense, the classic way was quite realistic in the sense that individual units didn't have to be absolutely perfect because they came usually with supplies and with more than just... And with their mindset. It's their mindset. You know, you hide in the top of a building and sort of say, like Tom Baker did in Destiny of the Daleks, say, well, if you're the master of the universe, you come up here and travel after me. The Dalek would probably go, right, and order an airstrike and blow the house up or just burn the house down. And I can't get up the stairs, but you're now on fire. So what's the problem? Moving on. And that sort of mentality is what Daleks should have. So in a sense, while I thought what Russell T. Davis did was very clever, in the sense it sort of gave the Daleks a strength which pop culture had taken from them, in a way, it sort of creates this problem, as you say, where you're having to look for fudges, when in a sense, Daleks don't necessarily need to be so powerful, because where they're powerful is that they just don't give a damn. There's no ethics there. So they don't have to be the perfect killing machine that can get upstairs when they can just destroy the building and not care about it.
Yeah, and that is the other like great thing about the Daleks, which I don't see them hit on too much, which is, unlike the Cybermen, which are a uniform race, the Daleks are essentially soldiers. They have ranks. They have personalities. You know, they just purged, and I think we hit on this before, but they just purged the emotions that they found were weak. So you can have, as Tom Baker jumps through there and tells them, you know, if you're the superior race, try climbing after me. You can have a bunch of Daleks that are sitting there going, well, crap, what do we do now? He just went up that vent. We can't fly, you know, because they're not this uniform race. That's just completely logical, even though we did get one story where that was an issue for them, sure. It was even that story. but, you know, it's just, you can have them kind of go, well, okay, great. I can order an airstrike, but do we have to talk to the Supreme Dalek? That probably, yeah, send the order. Let's talk to the Supreme, see what he wants to do. You know, because they're soldiers. They're individuals. They're people like us that just don't have the emotions that we have, and they don't have the ability to walk around like we do. So they walk around in their runabouts, you know, like, and that's what it is. And it's a very interesting concept that they need to play with a little more. There can be weak Daleks who don't know what to do and who can get chastised for not doing the right thing. I find that such a cool concept.
And maybe they need to. I mean, again, we don't want a sort of backseat drive on how to write Doctor Who, but maybe they need a chart where these characteristics are very clearly displayed for each monster. Because as we've said before, it's very easy. When these monsters start to fail is when they start to become generic to a story, where they don't, their personality template doesn't make much difference. They are just the monster of the week, and they lose what makes them a specific monster. So the differences between Cybermen, Daleks, Ice Warriors and Sontarans is four quite slightly different subcategories of antagonists. They should be really focused on what makes each one of those particular. And as you say, one thing to do with Daleks to try and separate them out from Cybermen is to take them away from the, as you say, the uniform race, and give them a little more of the identity that would then separate them out from what makes them scary compared to, or different to where the Cybermen are. And obviously the Ice Warriors have the ability to be, are flexible in the sense that they can be antagonists or they could be protagonists because they are patriotic soldiers.
That would be a very interesting thing. Take the Cybermen. Take that moment in. I don't remember which episode now. Take it from Age of Steel, when the Doctor and I'm unfortunately forgetting her character's name, but the woman, one of the freedom fighters, find that Cyberman that is a woman who is recanting the fact that she's supposed to be getting married. It's her wedding day. Her human side is coming out. Take that moment and do an entire story based on that, of a Cyberman that is stuck thinking that it's not this monster, but all of these people think it is, and they're fighting the heck out of it, you know? I think that would be an incredible story right there, where the humans, without trying to, are the bad guys. You know, so they're doing what they think they need to be doing because the Cyberman is coming at them, but the Cyberman's not a real threat. And it would be, to me, like there's no real danger there. The danger is being just fear itself. Yeah. And I think that would be such a cool concept to play on because, you know, we do get the fact that Cybermen are always so uniform and you either play to their strengths, which is you just use that uniformity and make that scary as hell, or you twist it a little bit and give somebody something new. And while they did that tiny little moment, which was a nice moment, I think there's a base for an entire full story there, which really could work very well.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that's true. And to be fair to the show, I mean, with the Daleks, they have been doing that a little in so far. If you take Asylum of the Daleks, you do have them showing fear, you know, the fear of going down there, the fear of their own insanity and perhaps the overplayed fear of the Doctor, which probably is getting a little old now. But I think you're right. I mean, but again, what you suggest is a very stripped back story where you pull it all back and you just focus on that one single facet. And I think the show needs to try and do that with these big monsters, is to pull it back and treat them perhaps more as individuals rather than, as you say, empires, because I think that's where they'll get the meat out of it or something.
And we've said that. Yeah. And we've said that with finales for
years. Yes, absolutely. Definitely. I mean, to me, I think that's the sad thing about finales. I mean, a finale which has even your story scenario could work as a finale if the ending was powerful and poignant enough.
Sure.
And the ramifications of it could be poignant enough or character changing or finale making. And it would certainly get away from the whole, you know, universe exploding. So I said a million times before, whether it's your town, your country, your earth, your solar system, your galaxy, it comes a point where the brain doesn't categorize, can't correlate it. So why get to the point where you're constantly trying to blow absolutely everything up when to the person watching it, that's no more different than blowing up your town, is because your brain can't go that far. And it just becomes a routine, a regular thing. It's just such a shame. I know we're going to sound like old bastards, but just thinking back to, you know, the William Hartnell era, and I can't think of many stories where the whole universe was at stake. It was, you know, getting out of a problem, whether it be on an alien planet or down a plug hole or against the Aztecs. It was so much more collective. And I think these big monsters sometimes end up just being used to further these massive manic plans. When, as you say, you could bring them back and just look and see, you know, what they'd almost be doing. It's like comics doing. Comics do this quite well. We should end soon. But comics do this quite well, where they say, they'll say do a miniseries on a particular character or a particular race, and it will just be a focus on, say, one of them. And maybe they need to do a series of that in Doctor Who, say four episodes in a series, maybe in a row, which is just about one version of an enemy, and it focuses more on that character than it does on the Doctor or on the standard tropes. I don't know.
There's ways, and you know, once again, comes down to the creative writer, and all they have to do is have somebody allow a creative writer to do that story. So you have two things here. You have a block that, instead of thinking small and interesting, everybody's trying to think, how can we be more grand than the last time? And then you have somebody who is in charge saying, no, you need to be more grand than the last time. What you need is a change on both ends of that spectrum. And people can start seeing some more intimate and interesting stories. And not to say that we don't get some, but, you know, they don't need to be structured that the end of the season is always that carbon copy of the last one. So it can absolutely be done. You know, will we get it with a change of hands, or will we get it with the current guy who realizes, hey, maybe I can do that? We'll find out, I guess. We'll see what this season brings. It'll be a fun ride, I hope.
Well, as we've said before, he's done it with Sherlock, so there's no reason I see why he can't do it with Doctor Who.
Sure.
But we're going to do a carbon copy of last week and end with recommendations. So if you've got any recommendations for anyone this week, I mean, anything that springs to your mind that you think?
Anything that springs to mind? You know, honestly, as I said, I've been rather busy. I haven't been doing anything Doctor Who related or otherwise to recommend something for people to watch. I'm trying to think. I know we talked about a lot of things, but I've already recommended some of these things recently. So what I'm going to do instead is I'll tell you a quick story that I wanted to tell you. Might as well leave it in the podcast because I wanted to tell Christian too, but I'm sure he'll listen to it. So there you go. I met again our listener, Don from Philly. into my booth at the convention. Very nice man. And I'll tell you what, he gave us a very nice compliment. He said that he enjoys every one of our podcasts. He really likes the dynamic of the three of us. He likes when you and I get our alone time and you and Christian as well. But what he said was he said, I don't know how you do it. He said, there's nothing going on right now. There's no new shows. The news has been bland. I don't know how you do it. You always find something interesting to talk about. And I really appreciated that. And I thought you would appreciate that. And I know Christian will as well. But it was a very nice compliment.
So essentially, you recommend Don from Philly.
I recommend Don from Philly. Very nice guy. Go meet him. And I'm sure he can tell you what kind of awesome podcast to listen to. That's my recommendation.
It is scary because we came into this podcast. We've both been busy this week and sort of sat down and thought, oh, my God, without the Corley, we've actually got nothing planned. Yeah. So to actually go over an hour with just an improvised agenda is kind of cool. But it's the nature of the show, I think. Got to say that the show, 50 years of it, just means it's always something that it can give you. And I think that's where we will end it. I would say I don't really have any particular recommendations this week. The only thing I will possibly recommend is that you try reading our comments, leaving a comment, get involved, and we will read and we will do our best to reply and listen to what you say. Because as I say, last week there was stuff said that I hadn't realised and I had to stand and correct myself. Because, you know, we're not the be-all perfect Doctor Who fans. We are fallible people just chatting about it on this weird internet things. So thank you very much to everyone listening to this. Thank you to Christian if you end up editing this, because I'm sure it'll be another hellhole for you to do. And we will talk to you another time.